How you guys doing with the time change? This is my favorite one of the two. But frankly, I 99% of the time, that's probably an accurate statistic, I'm still going to find a way to use the snooze bar. I really like to stay in bed. And so you give me an extra hour, I'm still going to apply the same behavior to that extra hour of sleep. I actually am a morning person, but there's this period of time every day where I'm like, no, I'm not ready to start. I like to stay in bed. And maybe if you're like me, you can justify, you hit the snooze bar the first time, like what's another 9 minutes? And then the second time you're like, I'll just skip brushing my teeth. And you hit it. Then you hit it a third time. I'll just skip the shower, eat in the car. And then, you know, the fourth or the fifth time, it's like, I'll just drive 95 miles an hour to work. You justify it and you justify it and you justify it. Some of us more than others. Man, I just love to stay in bed. Love to stay asleep. I began my faith journey thinking that following Jesus, being a good Christian, had to do with becoming the kind of person that gives their faith to God and then goes and changes the world, addressing the issues. The issues that we've heard about on whether it's news or talking heads on TV, that they're preachers or books or whatever. These issues, things that are attacking faith, attacking church, attacking values. And over and over and over, it's something to be aware of, to be alerted to take a stand for. This group's agenda and this ideology and post-modernity and all these things, all these issues. So I thought it would be interesting last night as I was thinking about how our culture talks about that, how I used to talk about that. And so I typed the phrase into the Google search bar, "Wake up Christians." I just wanted to see. And just shy of 83 million hits. So I read them all. The extra hour afforded me that. I couldn't find one. Obviously, there was a couple I didn't get to, but I couldn't find one that didn't and wasn't addressing them and they. And wake up, Christians, because this agenda is coming. Wake up, Christians. Because the church is under attack. And wake up, Christians, because this policy, this politic, this person, wake up. Every single one that I read, when you say wake up, Christians, you're talking about the external world. Be aware. You are unaware. Wake up to this thing that's happening. But so here's what I would like to suggest, because this is what I've learned in my journey, that 83 million times the point was lost. Because wake up. What it means, wake up. Not to fixate on somebody else, but to know who you are. So the series that we've been in, we've talked a lot about me too, and there's nothing you can do to get me off your team. And we focused on the two, the with, the also. I'm with you. We're family. First we belong. I'm not going to make you believe things before you belong. You belong, and then we'll get to belief later. I'm with you too. Also, today I want to talk about the me part of me too, because it's critically important to understanding what we're getting at. And so there's really what I'm talking about today is very lofty. It's really hard, and I wrestled with this a lot last night. How do I give this practical handles so that you can really kind of figure out what's going on? But it's at the same time, it just has to be introductory and lofty and way up in the air where we get nosebleeds, because I have to leave it that way so that you all can go and finish the sermon. If I finish it, you'll walk out and none of us will deal with it anymore. I have to leave it up there and you figure out a way that it's applicable. If I get really specific, then as I'm listing off specific things, you'll go, okay, I didn't hear my thing, I'm exempt. But the difficulty is then I have to leave it very general. And you're going to have that sense of, what are we talking about here? You have to figure that out. This is how I preach when I don't prepare. It's your fault. I just found out I was preaching 15 minutes ago. No, I'm kidding. Wake up, Christians. Wake up, faithful people. Oh, you're talking about wake up because they are doing things they shouldn't be. And we're letting them get away with it. No, 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 no. Jesus is always saying, why are you dealing with their stuff? Let's deal with your stuff. Do you even know your stuff. Jesus says something fascinating in Matthew chapter 7. He says, hey, you're going to have this impulse, this propensity to look all the way across the room and go, aha, I see a speck of sawdust in your eye. He says, you're going to be good at that. But I tell you, why don't you remove the log from your eye and then you will see clearly. And see, what a lot of us do is we take this passage, and we've dealt with it here at Crosspoint. We take the passage and we think it's procedural. Oh, here's how you properly judge somebody. First, you go in the bathroom, check your eyes. Do I struggle with that? Okay, if I do, nobody knows about it. Or I don't, good, that makes it worse than any sins I do deal with. And so then this is how you properly judge somebody. First, make sure you don't have a log in your eye. And then, boom, then you call out the little speck of sawdust in theirs. But I don't think Jesus is being procedural. And this isn't going to be a message on how to properly judge others. First, judge yourself, then do it. There's a discipline. There's a principle. There's a spiritual depth to be plumbed in what Jesus is saying. And it's this. You can spot sawdust a mile away in somebody else's eye and not realize you're looking past an oak tree to do it. First, why don't you get that out of your eye? And then you will see clearly. It's not a trip to the bathroom. It could take you decades to be able to see clearly. And then you might find on the other side, oh, there was never a speck at all. The speck in your eye is one of the leaves on my tree. It could take decades of reflection and seeing and waking up. But we prefer to deal with the outside world. We prefer to deal with appearances, with our shell. We love to stack up rules and ideas. We're very acquisitive. We like not only to collect things, but ideas, so we can constantly be talking and triangulating off of this thing, these people, the programs that they comprise, all the policies or the structures that are in place. We love to deal with the outside world. Over and over and over, we find that we're really good at dealing with the outside world. Isn't it amazing? When you're driving in traffic, give yourself 2 seconds and you can determine if somebody's an idiot or a moron. In a car, I don't even need to see their face, just their taillights. Idiot, 2 seconds. But you have to pay a therapist for a year to get to know 1% of yourself. Isn't it interesting how easy you can figure out other people, but you, yourself, you're a mystery. Isn't that interesting? See, we prefer and we're good at dealing with the rest of the world. We can take on the whole world. Many people, in the name of faith, I'm included in this lot, of saying, good, we're faithful people, let's go change the world. Let's go change our city, let's go change the world. Jesus never tells us to change the world. How can you change something you don't understand? Many of us, we go and we change the world. We go out to go change things so we never have to deal with our own world. Jesus is always going, why are you fixated on other people? Well, Jesus, we want to make sure that the outside of the cup is clean. And Jesus goes, no, clean the inside of the cup first. Then the outside will take care of itself if you do that properly. Always, always, always inviting us into the scary realm of knowing ourselves and dealing with our own world primarily. The rich young ruler story, one of my favorites in all the New Testament. This guy comes up to Jesus and he says, Jesus, teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? It's not how can I make sure that if I die tonight, I'm going to heaven? It's a much deeper conversation than that. What he's saying is, how can I live an eternal quality of life? How can I live in such a way as that as a human being, I am living congruently with my creator's will? How can I live in such a way that you can tell he's my king? I'm not the king. He's the king. Jesus, how can I live a life of the kingdom? And Jesus goes, well, good Jew, you know the commands, and he lists off some commands. And the guy goes, yes, teacher, I know those. I've kept those. I've kept those since I was young. Now, many times what we go, oh, he's lying. He's deluded. Nobody can follow the law. He won't admit that he's a bad person. Jesus doesn't do that. You can almost sense Jesus's excitement that he said that. Jesus, I know the law. I know the commands. I know Torah. And I know what to do when there's an infraction, when you break something, how to get things back right, and atonement and sacrifices. I know the system. I have all that information. What I'm telling you is I still feel a deficit. Even though I've got that, I've got the rules, I get this, I still feel like there's something else. And Jesus, maybe if you just imagine him leaning forward and going, oh, are you ready for the real stuff? So you're ready to deal with what's actually going on here? Jesus doesn't teach him any more Bible. Jesus doesn't teach him about himself. Jesus says, I'm going to teach you about you. Go sell all you have, give the money to the poor, and follow me. And it says, the man goes away sad. That's what it says in English. But the actual Greek is, he goes away perilipos, which means messed up in the head. He's nervous. He's perturbed. He's not, aww. He's, holy, am I doing this? He's actually considering it. It doesn't say what he actually decides. The writer wants you to know, this is what happened internally. Jesus is going, okay, so you've got your performance in line. You associate with the Jewish law. You've got that part figured out. You notice that hole? Are you ready? You want to go there? Let me show you what's really in your way. It's inside your head. And the guy goes away going, oh, this is a whole other level. You are showing me what I really care about. There comes a point where Jesus won't teach you anything new. He will not teach you any more Bible. He will not teach you any more about it. Now, we love this. I want a church that takes you and goes deep. What do you mean, the original languages? Because what Jesus is talking about is, let's deal with what's in your head. Let's know you. Jesus is taking us to the very scary depths of knowing who we actually are, inviting us into the difficult, intimidating process of knowing what we're saying when we say, I give myself to you, Jesus. So we spend a lot of time as a church saying, which Jesus, the Jesus of religion or the actual Jesus, who the incarnation of God, Jesus of Nazareth, a Galilean, Palestinian Jew who lived in accord with Torah and spoke and was fully human and fully God. Which Jesus are we talking? See, we spend a lot of time talking about that. And then I give myself, I surrender my, what are we saying? Well, I loan myself. I want me back at the end, you know, at the end of the week. What are we talking? See, those are important concepts, but just as important is, what do you mean when you say, I give me? What do we mean when we say, I have, who's the person we're referring to? And Jesus is saying, when you're ready, that's where we're going. This is why I'm so excited about, even though this is going to feel nebulous and you're going to, you know, you'll fall asleep halfway through this meeting. I'm so excited because this is what the journey that God is taking me on. You really think I sent my son so you could know stuff? Do you want to actually know who you are? Do you want to actually know what I mean when I say, I love you, Steve? Do you want to know the Steve I'm referring to? That's a scary thing. The philosopher Immanuel Kant, he said this. He referred to it as the hard descent into the hell of self-knowledge. Sign me up for that. That sounds like fun. Let's do that. Church, Sunday nights. Hey, everybody, let's take a trip to hell and really get to know ourselves. He recognized, like so many people have recognized, it is scary. There's so many different people who think for a living that realize, oh, man, we just would really rather not know ourselves. We would much rather stay asleep. And when we do wake up, let's just make sure it's about dealing with other people. But in terms of ourselves, let's stay in bed. That's too scary. It's just too scary. It's scary to ask, why do you do the things that you do? Why do you like what you like? Why do you feel the way that you feel about certain issues? And how do you really feel underneath how you're supposed to feel so nobody thinks you're a monster for how you actually feel? Why do you argue about the things that you argue about? Why do you get angry about the things that you choose to get angry about? Where does that come from? When you explain it, do you use the word just? Oh, it's just that, and then you give some superficial reason for that. Or do you actually know what's going on? It's scary. It's difficult. It's hard. And some of us go, yeah, that sounds important, but I would rather deal with it when everything's easier. But Jesus is inviting us into this really scary territory. You want me to continue teaching you some facts so you can acquire knowledge, so you can be puffed up on things that you know? Or are you ready to actually know who we're referring to when we talk about you and I? See, it's scary, but at the same time, there's something about it that we want. And we've always wanted it. We know this instinctively beneath our fears that what I really would love to know is what I am. Remember Socrates, what he said? The unexamined life is not worth living. You understand that's not just something he wrote in a book. That's something he said. That's something he chose. They said, if you're going to continue asking tough questions about what's really going on in our heads, we're going to put you to death. So your choice is to become mute. You can walk around the streets, but you can't talk about these scary things about what we really are, Socrates, or we'll kill you. And he said, why would I want to live if I can't live in reality? If I can't actually help us to know who we actually are? The unexamined life isn't worth living. And the jury in Athens accommodated him. He died for this. And I'm fascinated by all of these different people, all of these different thinkers, gurus in the East and psychologists in the West and people throughout time and throughout history all over the planet come to this very similar conclusion that knowing who we are, knowing who I am underneath the presentation that I use so that I don't scare you away, so you'll want me around, so you'll respect me, so that I can feel good about that whole situation, underneath all that, it's a very noble thing to know who that person is. That I have deceived myself into thinking certain things about me that aren't true. And Jesus says, don't you want to know who you really are before you say, I give me to you? Are you ready? It's going to be scary. It's going to be hard, but you want it. Now, some of us right now, and I get this with respect, maybe in this room right now, we're saying, wait, this sounds really Eastern. And I want to remind you, Jesus grew up east of here. Wait, this sounds like New Age or some other kind of thought. Wait a minute. Isn't this faith about knowing Jesus? Not me, but knowing Jesus. As far as it goes, I absolutely agree. But let's ask some tough questions about that. What kind of relating are we talking about when we don't know who's on this side of the relationship and on the other side is ultimate reality, the source of all that has ever been and will be? What early theologians called the great mysterion, the great mystery that we can only understand anecdotally, metaphorically through different senses and the scriptures and study, but it still remains this cloud of unknowing, as other theologians have called it. On the other side is the great mystery, and on this side, there's a mystery. What do we mean when we say having a personal relationship with our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ? See, I want to say to us that this kind of interaction, in calling it a relationship, it can be near meaningless. We don't know what we mean when we say it. We just say it, but we don't know what we mean because we don't know who the person on this side of the line or the other side. And so what I'd like to suggest is that it can be a very dangerous thing to have a relationship to God and not know who I am in the picture. Then it becomes something I don't understand. I just say and even defend. It's a dangerous thing to not know who I am in a relationship. What good is the Christian faith if it's all about acquiring knowledge about everything else but me? What good is the Christian faith if it's just one more way human beings can figure out if they're right or not? What good is the Christian faith if I can talk about knowing Jesus, but I still live anxiously, desperately, fearfully, grasping at things, holding on to things, hoping to keep some semblance of control underneath? What good is the Christian faith if I'm not actually transformed, but I boldly, on the authority of scripture or a select scripture or a denomination or a view, or I go try to change the world and I'm not different? What good is it? It's another act. What good is it? And so Paul, he's writing a letter to a young church in Rome, and it's heavy. The book of Romans is heavy. I mean, really, really smart people have wrestled with it for centuries, trying to figure out what Paul is getting at and the ramifications of what he's saying. You know, hey, this is what God has been up to all along. And he talks about, hey, Jews, don't think that you're better than the non-Jews, the Gentiles, just because this was first for the Jew and then the Gentile. You're not better than anybody. You're being a little arrogant. Don't you realize all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God? This isn't something you say to complete strangers. It's the way of getting the Jewish people to get down off their high horse. Whoa, 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 whoa. You're no different than the Gentiles. And then the Gentiles start to get caught cocky, and a couple chapters later, he goes, whoa, 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 you were grafted onto the tree. You're not even a natural branch on this thing, so let's not get cocky. Everybody, let's just chill out and be humble. And then, so it goes on and on, talk about all the magnificent things that God has done, and he gets to this kind of fever pitch at the end of chapter 11, like, oh, how great are the mysteries and the works of God. I don't even know how to express it. And you just imagine him writing as fast as he can. So then he gets to chapter 12, where he's going to kind of turn the corner and say, so let me tell you what this does. Now that we have all this information, let me tell you what this actually does. And you get to Romans chapter 12, and it reads this way. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, by the mercy of God, present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice acceptable to God. Present your bodies on the altar. See, the Jewish context would be, yeah, you put something else on the altar. You put an animal on there. In other religions, you put maybe your sons or daughters to let God know how serious you are. This is how much I'm willing to give up, my kids. Paul was persecuting the church. He was having Christians killed. He was hauling them off on the authority of the Jewish officials, hauling off Christians and putting them in jail, creating orphans, saying, this is a scourge. These people are worse than Baal worshipers, because in the name of our God, they're not going into the temple. They don't uphold the law. It's all about this Jesus that apparently died and then resurrected. Out of zeal for God, protecting God from impurity, because God needs our protection. He was willing to put other people on the altar, and he says, no, I'm awake now. And so put your bodies, not your ideas, not another person or a thing, not your principles or your doctrines or your church or your faith, put you on the altar. What you really are on the altar, which is your spiritual service of worship. The literal Greek is a little different. What it actually says is your reasonable act of service, or reasonable act of worship. It's as though Paul is saying, what do you expect me to say in what we're supposed to do in response? That we're going to go out and try to control other people's behavior, or that we're going to go make this about something else? No. The only reasonable response is, do you know who you are in relation to this amazing God? This is about actually waking up. This is about seeing. Put you on the altar. That's the only reasonable response. And don't be conformed to this world. It's asleep. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind, or the renewing of your thinking, so that you can prove. You want to prove what the will of God is. You have your mind transformed so that you can prove what that is, the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. And the next phrase is, but assess yourself soberly. Don't fly up at 30,000 feet looking at yourself and then look really, really close at everybody else. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to, but think of yourself soberly. If in other words, if you're not looking at yourself with scrutiny, examining yourself, really knowing yourself, that's the behavior of a drunk person. Examine yourself soberly. This is your response to how great God is. Know who you are when you say, I want to give myself to him. That's the gift, that you would actually enter into the scary waters of knowing who you are in relation to him through Christ. But see, here's part of the rub for me is neither I nor anyone else can just teach you this. I'm not actually teaching you this right now. My hope today is just what our appetites and give us a glimpse that maybe we much prefer to stay in bed until we're dealing with somebody else, when it's time for us. No, I'll sleep. I'll dream. You know, that's, I want to view myself through the lens of dreaming, but I can't teach you this. This is something we have to do by entering into life with God, by entering into the circumstances we've grown used to avoiding and actually taking God on. You don't heap on other things. You don't build additions onto your facade to become, okay, now I'm becoming spiritual because I'm adding more information. I'm becoming more and more and more and more. It's about a stripping. It's about an exposing. It's about the terrifying, difficult work of dealing with what is underneath what you've gotten so used to calling you. And that's why Jesus says in John chapter 12, unless a seed dies. Get that slide? John chapter 12. Very truly, I tell you, unless a seed, a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only that single seed. It doesn't ever do anything. But if it dies, if it's willing to die, to be buried in the ground and die, then it produces seeds and produces fruit. See, we all want to self-actualize. I want to be everything that I'm supposed to be. I want to achieve everything I'm supposed to. No more, no less. That's what I want. But Jesus says, the way that you do that is you have to die. There's a metaphoric death that has to take place in order for what's truly you to produce fruit. We have to lay ourselves bare before God. We have to wake up. We have to see, to step into the light. All those metaphors throughout the scriptures. And what's at stake is we all want resurrection. We want our minds renewed. We want resurrection. We want enlightenment. But Jesus says, I want you to have that too. But it comes through the agony of death. Resurrection always follows crucifixion. What we would rather do is observe the crucifixion and see if we can get smart and self-aware off of it. Nah, it doesn't work that way. Resurrection happens after death. But everything in our culture teaches us to avoid pain. Something has gone wrong if we're experiencing pain. So we distance ourselves from difficult people. We think that God has failed when something bad happens. Geez, I had all the faith in the world and yet this still happens. And I'm not saying God causes things to happen, but God is inviting us to allow circumstances to crucify everything in us that's not us. Our whole society prides itself on staying comfortable and avoiding discomfort. But it's through relational and physical and economic and emotional, financial difficulties that we get a chance to be the person that God is redeeming. Not the mannequin that I present to everybody, but the person God is referring to when he says, I love you, Steve. Christianity isn't defending or talking about or observing the crucifixion of Jesus. It's entering into it. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he says, when Christ calls the man, he bids him to come and die. That is terrible PR. But this is the path. And some people use the path. They use Christianity to avoid crucifixion because they'll talk and meet and read and congregate around the ideas and never allow their inner worlds to be fully exposed and fully known so that they can say with integrity, I give myself to Jesus. I have the peace of knowing what I am. I'm not pretending. I don't deceive myself. I'm raw and unthreateningly honest about what I am. That's the last great frontier. But it's understandable. It's way easier and safer and more comfortable to observe a crucifixion than to undergo one. But following Jesus is none other than an invitation to do that. All your fears and anxieties, the false self, a broken ego, your performances and your survival tactics, all of that put to death so that you can actually be the person that you actually are. And it's harder than an actual crucifixion. With an actual crucifixion, somebody just grabs you and sticks you to a pole and you die. This is something you have to do. You have to put yourself on the altar. It's up to you how much of this work that you're willing to do. But if you don't awaken, if you don't see, how are you supposed to love anybody? Who's doing the loving? How are you supposed to be loved? What are people loving? If it's not you, it's this shell around you. You don't know who you are. How are you ever going to live your life? See, if we don't wake up, we miss our life. We miss out on our whole life. And in the name of Jesus, I've missed a lot of my life because I wanted to stay asleep. And I would wake up every time it was somebody else's issue to deal with. I made a living off of it. And I was asleep, referencing myself. And so I've seen in my own life, and I've seen as a pastor, the desire to be esteemed, driving people to love people in the name of Jesus. But what they're really trying to do is get the esteem and the respect they never had as a kid. I've seen people so worried about being esteemed and loved that they become pastors and they become missionaries. And of course, good things happen from that. But the impetus was using people pharmaceutically. I am going to get the respect I've entitled myself to and I never got. And I will not face that what this is actually about is me. seen it over and over. More times than I can count. I've seen adults live out careers having degrees in certain fields. And they hate it. They absolutely hate it, but they will not face the fact that what they're doing well into their 40s, 50s, 60s, trying not to disappoint their parents. They in that column never grew up because they didn't want to disappoint their parents. And they do for a living something they hate. They think that they want to be good at it and they can't figure out why they're miserable. They spend 50 hours a week doing something they hate. They will not face it. I've seen people hide an internal faith crisis. I've seen people stuff atheism underneath confronting strangers with faith. Over and over, I've seen this. I've seen it on TV. I've seen it firsthand. People bombastically going after people, trying to convert them. And what they're doing is just absolutely refusing to wake up and to see that they're having an internal faith crisis. They won't see it. I've seen people with sexual issues that bury it underneath hurling insults and condemnation at other people that seem to just embrace what they themselves deny. Over and over and over. I see people resigning that, you know what, I'm just kind of laid back. Maybe I'm kind of lazy. I take a chill approach to life. It has nothing to do with laziness. People say, yeah, he's lazy. She's just lazy. There's no such thing as lazy. This person has absolutely given up on trying anything because if you don't try anything, you can't fail. They're so obsessed with not being a failure in somebody else's eyes. I'll allow you to think I'm just laid back and a little bit lazy. If I never try anything, I never fail. And then I can't disappoint you. And they won't face it. They won't face it. They believe about themselves, this is just who I am. It's not who they are. I see it over and over and over. I've seen it in my own life. I've seen people, and I've seen it myself, a propensity to argue things that you don't believe. Because winning means having worth. And so the act of winning trumps accuracy. And not admitting to yourself, you don't believe this. You just don't want to get to the end of this and go, you know what, you're right. Because you believe you're going to be worthless if you get there. I've seen it over and over and over. We're asleep, sound asleep in an argument. I've seen people hide their interests and passions and say, I'm not interested in that. I'm not passionate in that. And they're not even lying. They believe that they're not. And deep down, that's exactly, they love it. They can't find a way to make it fit spiritually or in their vocation. If I can't make money doing it, it has no worth. They're trying to impress somebody that doesn't even have a face in the back of their mind. And they will not admit it to themselves. They never step into what they really are because they're scared it won't garner respect. I've seen couples argue and condemn each other for years. And what's really going on is they assume that the other thinks that they're stupid. And so they walk around feeling the man feels emasculated, the woman feels disrespected and unloved, but that's not actually happening. They're projecting their own insecurities. They will not face the fact that when they do something, they have high hopes that they'll finally be seen as a person of worth. They won't face it. And so they argue and argue and argue, and it's not the other person. I see it in so many different places. I see it in my own life. You see it in your own way. So many of us were born asleep. We go to school asleep. We grow up asleep. We get married asleep. We have kids that are sleeping. We raise them in our sleep. We retire asleep, and we die asleep. Wake up, Christians. Oh, are we talking about somebody else? Because then I'll swing my feet over the side of the bed. If not, I'm going to use Jesus as a comforter. Over and over and over and over, we see this. And Jesus says, you ready? You don't really think I came, lived, healed, taught, and died so you could know things. How would you like to actually be you and know who I am in relation to that? Are you ready? You're ready to deal with actually knowing yourself? You ready to go down that rabbit hole with me? I want to give you a couple things, and then we're gonna meditate a bit. Just some ideas. The first is simply this: just acknowledge this. Acknowledge you don't want to wake up. I don't want to wake up. Everything in you will fight it, and so we'll exempt ourselves. We'll think, no, I've already arrived. I've already done enough. I don't want to wake up. I don't want to face me. And so we'll feel very passionate about something else. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to wake up. Just acknowledging that. Let's not fix anything about that. Let's just acknowledge step one. You and I don't want to wake up. Just knowing that. Wow, I really try to crawl back in bed every chance I get. Now, my body moves around and I'm involved in things and I work and I go to school and blah, 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 blah. But when it comes to me, I choose blindness. I don't want to see. I don't want to know. I don't even want to think about knowing what I would find. First thing, just acknowledge, we want to stay asleep. Second thing, you and I have a propensity to blame others. It's reflexive. And so you won't consciously think, who can I blame so I don't have to focus on myself? That's not how it works. You'll just find yourself gossiping, negative, judgmental, rolling your eyes, reading the newspaper, trying to find where's the scandal, always trying to deal with the outside world. We do it with faith. We do it with politics. We do it with our family. We do it all over the place. It's always, always, always about somebody else. We'd rather stay asleep. We reflexively put the blame on other people. Here's a third thing. We call these things disciplines. It's not a great word, but it takes discipline until it becomes a way of life. When we talk about generosity, not just we at church, but when we're talking about being generous, we all want to be generous. We just don't want to employ generosity because then something goes off in our heads. If you give this away, you're not going to have it. Generosity is, with our time, with our money, with what it means when we say resources, blesses people, but it also is one of the ways we crucify greed, the thing we would never want to find out was in us, but it's there. All greed is fear. Generosity crucifies greed. Well, when I get the raise or the promotion or when this, you know, irons out or blah, blah, blah. No. It's going to be hard. Generosity is a way of crucifying a false, greedy, selfish, scared self. It's what it does. You benefit from it as well. Serving. I don't really have time to serve as much, or I'll serve a little bit and check a box and then I can feel good about it. No. Serving is a way of saying my life is not my own. I give myself. I lift others' interests up. And if I only do it when I want to, I'm never going to do it. Serving is a way of giving internal resources to other people. Serving is a way of crucifying self-preference. It crucifies the false, broken ego so that the image of God, always wanting to love, can be freed so you can know that person. Talk about Sabbath. Sabbath is like, oh, you don't work so you can take a nap. Sabbath is for going to sleep. No. Sabbath is for waking up and staying that way. A lot of us, we have it backwards. When we continue to work really hard, that's sleepwalking. When we don't know how to stop, we don't know how to have rhythm, you're asleep. Sabbath, even if we nap during our Sabbath, our rest times, it's how we make sure we stay awake. I am not part of the machine. I am not what I produce. My worth doesn't come from constant movement. And the fact that these are difficult, these and so many other things, they're difficult. It's God inviting us to, rather than avoiding difficulty, let it crucify the false parts of ourselves so we can actually know who we are underneath our presentations. And a fourth thing. And I'm sure there's probably 40. Don't be scared what you find. Because some of what you won't, what you're going to find as you do this examination, you won't feel like you fit. Maybe at church or in your family, you won't fit a certain ideology. Your interests that bubble to the surface, there's no way that'll get any respect. I don't know where that comes from. Oh, I was angry at me, not her. Don't be threatened by any of that, because whatever you're scared of, you hide from. And then you have to start over. Don't be scared of what you find. Unthreatened, uncritically see it. Wake up to it. And then you and Jesus can work on you. And then through you, his kingdom efforts will come to pass.